In this nation and in this state, we amend our Constitution to extend rights, not strip them away.
The court is the arbiter of what the Constitution means.
All they knew was 10 minutes of music and that they should keep articulating what was going on in their head as they were listening.
My body feels like it's floating.
Just overwhelms your senses for a minute and you can get lost in it.
Six more minutes?
Honey, I'm tired of listening to this.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Queer Kiwis worry over loved labor's loss. Prop 8's ball is back in the California High Court's court, and a musical documentary tests ear imagination coordination. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending November 15th, 2008. After 9 years in power, New Zealand's Labour Party lost its majority in national elections on November 8th. The right-leading National Party won 59 seats in the 121-member parliament. Labour won 43. The Greens won 8, the Progressives took 1, and 2 minor parties took 5 seats each. There will still be 6 out gay or lesbian MPs in the new parliament, the same number as were elected in 2005. With the leadership of supportive Prime Minister Helen Clark, Labour steered a National Civil Unions Act into law in 2004 and abolished discrimination against same-gender couples with additional legislation in 2005. National Party leader John Key will become New Zealand's 38th Prime Minister. Retiring openly gay MP Tim Barnett told GayNZ.com that the incoming government worries him and that he hopes the Nationals won't attempt to roll back the progress achieved under the Labour Party. There will be a number of MPs in the governing party who do not have a great deal of tolerance for lesbian and gay New Zealanders, and some of them used homophobic themes in their campaigns, he said, so there's good reason to be nervous. He said that Parliament's equality agenda is not now so much about changing laws as changing practices in government departments, the province of individual ministers. He said he doubts that there will be many National Party leaders who'll be prepared to stick their neck out to be friends to our community.
But 2 measures extending hate crime protections to gays and lesbians have been adopted by the Hungarian Parliament, according to a report this week by the British-based PinkNews.com. A hate crime will be defined in a more general way as a violent act against a member of a social group, which is believed to include sexual orientation. The second piece of legislation makes it possible to initiate civil proceedings against a person who engages in degrading or intimidating behavior towards groups based on nationality, ethnicity, religion, or sexual orientation. LGBT activists in Hungary have clashed with police in recent years, and pride events in the country have been violently attacked by right-wing and religious fundamentalist groups. The hate crimes provisions are part of a wider bill on the protection of public order. Government officials reportedly shied away from mentioning LGBT people and the hate crime elements in the explanation of the bill or in the parliamentary debate. Hungary's socialist government has adopted several bills in recent years to sanction less severe forms of hate speech, but all attempts have been struck down by the Constitutional Court as violations of free speech. It's therefore uncertain if the new laws will pass judicial muster.
Some 230 activists from 40 nations gathered in Vienna in early November for the 12th annual conference of the European region of the International Lesbian and Gay Association, or ILGA. Attendees included the Council of Europe's Human Rights Commissioner, Thomas Hammerberg, Austrian President Heinz Fischer served as an honorary patron of the gathering, and Austrian Minister of Justice Maria Berger attended the opening session. Vienna Mayor Michael Hoppel hosted a reception for delegates at City Hall. ILGA Europe's 2009 conference will be in generally less welcoming Malta, and the 2010 meeting will be in the Dutch capital of The Hague.
The long battle to overturn India's colonial-era ban on carnal intercourse against the order of nature, Penal Code Section 377, may finally soon be resolved. The Delhi High Court has been hearing arguments and reviewing legal briefs since the case was first filed by the NGO HIV/AIDS Prevention and Sexual Minorities Advocate NAS Foundation 7 years ago. The court ordered the petitioners and the government to file transcripts of their final oral arguments by November 17th. Section 377, which punishes offenders with up to life in prison, has rarely been enforced in modern times. But LGBT advocates say it's been used by police and extortionists to target sexual minorities for abuse. The judges have not said when they'll announce their verdict.
Connecticut became the third U.S. state this week to open civil marriage to same-gender couples, just 8 days after California voters repealed that right. Connecticut and Massachusetts are now the only two states where gay and lesbian couples can legally tie the knot. The Connecticut High Court ruled 4-3 in October that the state constitution's equal protection guarantees demand marriage equality. One of the plaintiff couples in the four-year legal battle was among the first to get a marriage license on November 12th. Reporter Melinda Tuhus was on the scene for Free Speech Radio News.
Barbara and Robin Levine Ritterman were among the 8 same-sex couples whose victory at the Connecticut Supreme Court in September legalized same-sex marriage. The court ruled they had a right to equal protection under the state constitution. The couple had a commitment ceremony 16 years ago, and then were joined in a civil union when that became available in Connecticut in 2005. But standing on the steps of New Haven City Hall amidst white balloons, red roses, and supporters wearing big pink I do buttons, Barbara said that wasn't good enough when she went to the hospital for a cancer checkup.
When they said, "What's your marital status?" I said, "Civil union." And she said, "Oh, there's no place for that in the computer. I'll put you down as single," which just made me feel like I was back up there when the chemo almost killed me and worrying whether if I got sent to the intensive care unit, was Robin going to be able to come with me?
The Levine Rittermans haven't set a wedding date yet, but later in the morning, a lesbian couple that was not party to the lawsuit got married at City Hall. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
A partial tally from 130 of Connecticut's 169 cities and towns counted 66 same-gender couples who had applied for marriage licenses during the first 2 days they were legal.
The battle over California's Proposition 8 continues even after Election Day. Demonstrations in cities and small towns across the state, in some places where LGBT rights demonstrations have rarely been seen, have literally been held every day and night since California voters on November 4th approved the measure to eliminate the right of same-gender couples to civilly marry. An unprecedented national day of protests in as many as 300 cities are taking place across the U.S. as we record this newscast. In what gay journalist Rex Walkner has dubbed Stonewall 2.0, thousands of younger lesbi-gay people in particular are becoming activists for the first time, and they're organizing protests using Facebook and other social networking sites online. Meanwhile, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has become a specific target of LGBT anger as thousands have demonstrated at Mormon temples in Los Angeles, San Diego, Oakland, and at LDS headquarters in Salt Lake City, Utah. Mormons in several western states, in addition to California, provided massive financial and organizational support for Proposition 8, as they were urged to do by church leaders. Depending on who's doing the estimating, from 7,500 to 15,000 New Yorkers jammed the streets outside the Mormon temple in Manhattan to protest on November 12th.
Some LGBT leaders have questioned the targeting of Mormon church facilities, while others have justified those demonstrations by arguing that the LDS Church can't use religion to claim immunity from protests over their political intervention in what critics call a civil rights issue. They're free to believe what they wish, but the well-documented church advocacy of Proposition 8 stepped over the line, protest defenders say, when Mormons wanted to impose their religious views about marriage on the entire state. There have been reports of a few minor incidents of vandalism at some church buildings, and the No on Aid campaign issued a press release this week condemning any actions that aren't entirely peaceful. But they also pointed out that up to half of all the money raised to pass Proposition 8 came as a direct result of Mormon church actions. In fact, a report surfaced this week documenting an internal church memo in 1997 that urged the defeat of marriage equality efforts across the country. Then LDS President Gordon B. Hinckley was quoted as saying that Mormons needed to move ahead with the church's opposition to legal same-gender marriage.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger was on record as being opposed to Proposition 8, although he didn't actively campaign against it at all. He nevertheless said during a CNN interview this week that he hoped lawsuits that have been filed challenging the constitutionality of the voter-approved marriage ban would be successful and encouraged gays and lesbians who've been protesting its passage to never give up. But in an email to supporters this week, Tony Perkins of the right-wing Family Research Council condemned the governor for condoning street protests and supporting judicial activist scams to overturn a popularly approved state constitutional amendment, and said Schwarzenegger was approaching advocacy of anarchy.
43 members of the California legislature, including the leader of both the Assembly and the State Senate, have filed a friend of the court brief in support of the legal challenges to Proposition 8.
And finally, openly lesbian rock star Melissa Etheridge has also spoken out against Proposition 8. In a blog posting to the Daily Beast this week, she announced that passage of the marriage ban means I do not have to pay my state taxes because I am not a full citizen. Etheridge also questioned attempts to legislate morality. Gay people are born every day, she wrote. You will never legislate that away.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 15th, 2008. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Rick Watts.
A violinist turns filmmaker to watch music listeners add their own soundtrack later in the program. Just hours after California's Proposition 8 was approved by the voters, several lawsuits challenging its enforcement were filed with the state Supreme Court. The constitutional amendment that overturned marriage equality passed by a 52-48% margin on November 4th. The lawsuits asked the same court that ruled 4-3 to open civil marriage to same-gender couples to invalidate the measure. They argue that the state's constitution's equal protection provisions do not allow a simple majority to revoke the rights of a targeted minority. Reporter Dan Fritz was in the chambers of the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors this week when they voted to join the City of Los Angeles, Santa Clara County, and the City and County of San Francisco in the lawsuits challenging Proposition 8.
Opponents of gay marriage claim this is not a civil rights issue, and the majority has spoken against same-sex marriage. Catherine Lehman, racial justice director of the ACLU of Southern California, disagrees. She was at the Board of Supervisors meeting today.
It was really inspiring.
L.A. City Attorney Rocky Delgadillo was also there, along with his San Francisco counterpart, who both have filed suit with the state Supreme Court to have Prop 8 overturned.
In this nation and in this state, we amend our Constitution to extend rights, not strip them away. Proposition 8 flies in the face of the principle of equal protection and strips away fundamental rights.
The central issue in all the suits against Prop 8 is that the initiative effectively changes the Equal Protection Clause of the state constitution. According to Delgadillo and the other plaintiffs, which include the County of Santa Clara and now L.A. County, an amendment that requires a simple majority is not good enough to make major revisions to the constitution. But the state Supreme Court saw this argument before. Opponents of Prop 8 filed a petition with the court to have the state measure thrown off the ballot on the same grounds.
They declined to even hear that argument because the voters had not spoken yet. They figured that if the voters turned it down, then they wouldn't have to hear the argument because it would be moot. In this case, now it is ripe for them to hear, and we've now brought it directly to the California Supreme Court.
And the city attorney says it's important for city and county lawyers across the state to voice their opposition to Prop 8.
Officers of the court being connected to this lawsuit sends an important message to all involved that this is about justice
Layman at the ACLU says it was specifically important for L.A. County to stand up against the proposition.
Los Angeles County is the largest county in the state, and it's also a county in which Proposition 8 passed, according to the electorate. So it sends an important message to the court that this county is standing for the principle that the court is the arbiter of what the Constitution means.
Layman relates to the fight for same-sex marriage through her own family's struggle for interracial marriage in the 60s.
My parents were married in Washington, D.C., rather than in Virginia, where my mother was raised, because in 1966, Virginia still outlawed interracial marriage. My mother, who was black, could not at that time marry my father, who was white, in her home state. The United States Supreme Court outlawed race-based marriage restrictions the following year in Loving versus Virginia. And I was raised in the shadow of that decision and the Supreme Court decision in Brown that held that equal protection applies to all persons and that promised a new day of meaningful opportunity for people like me. I cannot imagine that this state would, through the tyranny of a majority vote, wipe away such fundamental constitutional protections.
Supervisors Zev Yaroslavsky, Gloria Molina, and Yvonne Burke, all Democrats, voted in favor of joining the lawsuit. The two Republican members, Don Kanabi and Mike Antonovich, were both absent for the vote. Antonovich had earlier stated he would not support the legal challenge, which he said should have been addressed prior to the election. Delgadillo says the state high court stays out of questions of constitutional conflict whenever possible. But now that the proposition has passed with a narrow majority, Delgadillo says the court will have to address the case.
We have been told that they want to act in an expeditious fashion. I'm hoping that that's something that will happen. When fundamental rights are taken away from any minority group, I believe it's important for us to act swiftly, thoughtfully, but swiftly, and do it right, and make sure that justice is served.
The California Supreme Court voted 4-3 in May that a state ban on same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. That ruling effectively elevated sexual orientation to the constitutional status of race and gender. Plaintiffs in the current suit argued that protected status would be violated by the enactment of Proposition 8. I'm Dan Fritz.
The Asian Pacific American Legal Center, Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, Equal Justice Society, California NAACP, and the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund have also challenged Proposition 8 at the California Supreme Court. In a joint press release this week, they argued that minority communities cannot be stripped of their fundamental rights by a simple majority vote. Legal experts say it's hard to predict how the court will act. Even before they rule on the constitutionality of Proposition 8, they could order an immediate stay of its enforcement. That might allow lesbian and gay couples to once again get marriage licenses in the state. But high court justices who will be up for re-election may hesitate to overrule the popular vote. Chief Justice Ronald George participated in a conference on the role of the courts in Berkeley this week. Although the event was not related to the Prop 8 battle, the author of the court's May Marriage Equality Majority Opinion told reporters that the justices are keenly aware that we share with other state courts a vulnerability to forces that focus not on impartiality, but on whether judges, like office holders in our sister branches of government, should be responsive to majoritarian, political, or special interest preferences. If the court upholds the validity of Proposition 8, LGBT advocates promised their own initiative effort in 2010 to overturn it.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra!
Have you checked our website for the latest This Way Out update? For a review of recent programming and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, just log on to www.thiswayout.org.
Violinist Paul Festa had an unusual idea for a movie. Apparition of the Eternal Church captures the responses of a select group of listeners to French Catholic composer Olivier Messiaen's work of the same name. Festa examines how people listen to music and how secular ears encounter sacred art. Some of those ears included literary critic Harold Bloom, filmmaker John Cameron Mitchell, actor-playwright Issa Davis, Broadway drag star Justin Bond, and Scissor's sister Singer animatronic. The film also caught the eye of This Way Out correspondent Dixie Treichel, who asked Festa how the concept was born.
My experience as a violin student at Juilliard, particularly my studies with a harpsichord virtuoso named Albert Fuller, provided the inspiration for this film. I came to him as a chamber music student, so I came with a piano trio, and we would play for him, and he would coach us. And then after our coaching was done, he would invite us over to his West Side studio. And we would listen to music late into the night, and we would talk about it. And it would be more accurate to say that Albert would talk, and we would listen. Mm-hmm. And the kind of stories that he told when we were listening to music, and the experience of having music essentially narrated or elucidated by someone whose imagination was as brilliant as Albert's and as operatic as Albert's, was a great part of my musical education. 10 years, actually, after I left Juilliard, when I first heard this piece by Messiaen, The Apparition of the Eternal Church, which is a 10-minute organ piece that Messiaen wrote when he was 24 years old, when I first heard it, I had this kind of out-of-body response. And my first thought was, when I was capable of thinking anything again, I thought, I have to play this for Albert Fuller. So I did, and I'm really not sure how I got the idea to put the camera on him while he was listening to the music through headphones, but that's what I did. His response was so wonderful. It really ran the gamut of emotion and experience and memory. And when it was through, I was inspired to just keep going and see if I could put together some sort of a film based on people's responses. 2 years later, I had about 115 interviews collected, and out of those interviews, the 31 make up the final film.
When these people were coming in to listen to this, did you give them any instructions prior, or did they just sit down and put the headphones on?
In the film itself, I show a few of the scenes where I'm telling people, it's like, well, is this sort of self-explanatory? Do you know what you're going to do? And there was very little, actually, to tell them because I told them nothing about what they were going to hear.
Okay.
I didn't want people to prepare or start telling me something rather involved about Messiaen or their experience listening. I didn't tell them that it was going to be Messiaen even as I put the music on, or that it was going to be organ music. All they knew was 10 minutes of music and that they should talk essentially through it. You know, it would be fine to take up to a half a minute to just sort of absorb at a time, but generally to try to keep articulating what was going on in their head as they were listening.
There is a path that the film provides for us, how people's emotions are changing with the piece.
Right. The most interesting responses to me were the people who had some kind of a breakthrough during the listening experience. It's the kind of music that's so overwhelming. It's aggressive. It's loud. It's often quite dissonant and uncompromising in various ways. Most music that we listen to, it really isn't emotional in that way. People are embarrassed by it, and people were put off by it because it was asking them to go someplace difficult and deep. So the most gratifying responses for me to watch and to play with later in the editing room were the ones that started off defensive, even dismissive, but at a certain point collapsed under the weight of all of that dramatic energy. And I think that in a certain sense, the film does this too. I mean, there are a lot of laughs in the first 25 minutes of the film. And then at a certain point, after people have really sort of dropped their defenses, the film does too. And there really aren't any more laughs after mm-hmm. that. Like, you just understand that we've just gone a little deeper, and that the thing that was so funny was really our own response. It wasn't the music itself.
That's the Sisyphus thing.
And even though I'm hearing it through headphones, I'm also vicariously experiencing being in the same room where this particular music is actually being produced.
If I were in a cathedral listening to this, I would be crying hysterically. I would repent all my sins. God, save me! Save me!
That length is what it feels like to be in that moment of, like, about to be killed, about to open a door.
A man with giant horns and fire licking up around him greets you.
It's so emotional. It's like somebody whipping their head back, you know, in anticipation. Their hair, like, flying off their skull.
It's so sexy. It's just like, which I know is not what he means it to be, but that's the way I hear it.
I feel that some of the chords, not all of them, some of the more complicated ones, are attached to my spinal column in some way.
How long does it go on? It's making me very unhappy. 10 minutes of this?
It's gonna be 10 minutes of this?
How many more minutes? How many more minutes?
6 more minutes? It's giving me a headache now.
Honey, I'm tired of listening to this.
The people in the film are people who walked into my apartment or whom I had studied with at one place or another, and I was able to get to sit down for this. In the sense that it was really just sort of my universe of people, then that's accounted for the large queer quotient. One of the really interesting things to me about looking at the demographics of the group is that here's Messiaen, who's this towering figure, not just in music, but in French Catholicism. I mean, he was the musical voice of French Catholicism for more than half a century. And while French Catholicism isn't maybe the most doctrinaire form of the religion, it's the religion that gave us a number of very difficult responses from the Vatican about homosexuality particularly, and it's a kind of orthodoxy that a lot of us would find really hostile. And yet, when you look at the people in the film whose response to the music is the most deeply felt, and the people who are the biggest Messiaen partisans, it's often like Jewish intellectuals and gay Jewish intellectuals. There really is a special resonance that some of us feel to this profoundly religious, devout music, even if we share, as Michael Warner, the queer English professor, says at some point in his interview, he says, even if we share none of the, what he calls meta-commentary, or just the religious beliefs that underlie the musical output.
There's also a book that's connected with it.
Yes, there is. I'm a big fan of director's commentaries, you know, not just about the film and the making of the film, but the music itself and the specific people that I'd interviewed. When someone's having a very emotional response, and particularly in this case when they're having an emotional response to a piece of music and an emotion registers on their face, it's really lovely to see it on video. Mm-hmm. It's even better to see it slowed down in slow motion, which there's quite a bit of in the second half of the film, but it's really great to stop it in the still image. The book is full of these still images, in addition to the full transcript of the film, everything that they've said, and then the director's commentary underneath. Messiaen was born in 1908, so this year is his centenary, and there are concerts and centenary festivals and celebrations happening all over the world all year. The actual birthday is in the second week of December. So I'm touring around with the film. I am also have had the really great pleasure and privilege to give a number of regional premieres, including the U.S. premiere of a Messiaen violin piece that was just published last year. So I'll be playing that in Austin this fall at the Library of Congress as well, in conjunction with the screening of the film.
You can find out more about Paul Festa and his film Apparition of the Eternal Church at www.apparitionfilm.com. Thanks to Dixie Trichel for sharing her interview with us. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, Dan Fritz, Sherry Lund, and Dixie Trichel contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to postal mail CDs or cassettes of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on 2YOU Tamworth, New South Wales, KDHX St. Louis, Missouri, WORT Madison, Wisconsin, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.